Hi, everyone. I'm Jen Malott, and welcome to the second episode of our Essential Antitrust podcast series. Today is Monday, February 3rd, and it's 3.5 years after the British people voted to leave the EU, and the UK is no longer an EU member state. So following decades of EU and UK competition law regimes being closely intertwined with one another, we've now started down this road to a separation. So I'm here today in London with two of our antitrust partners. First joining me, we have Alex Potter, who has significant experience with both the UK and the EU regimes and has also spent a lot of time working with other regimes and spent time in our Beijing office.
Hi there, Jen. Great to be here.
And we also have Deba Das here, who has worked with clients subject to UK and EU antitrust investigations. And he's appeared before the UK High Courts, the UK Competition Appeals Tribunal, and the European Courts on both competition matters and Brexit-related litigation.
Hi, Jen.
So Alex and Deba are here today to talk about some of the antitrust implications of Brexit, and in particular, what this is going to mean for the future of EU and UK competition law enforcement. And we're going to talk both about the legal and practical issues that are going to come up over the next year while we're in this so-called transition period and the steps that businesses should take to plan for that period. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about what this means in 2021 when we have two separate competition regimes. So first, Deba, if I could ask you, can you maybe give us a brief explanation about what actually happened last week on January 31st with regards to competition law regimes in the UK and the EU?
Sure. I mean, it's a big question. And the reality is, officially, as of the 31st of January, the UK has ceased to be a member of the European Union. Under the withdrawal agreement, though, the UK continues to be counted as a member until the end of 2020. So it's a case of gone but not quite forgotten. And what that means for competition law specifically is that EU competition law in the form of merger control, regulation of anti-competitive agreements, abuse of dominance, etc., all of that still applies in full as it does now until the end of the year. But after that period and subject to the trading relationship that will be agreed in the coming months with the EU, we will see an impact on how deals get approved, how companies should go about managing risk in the face of multiple investigations into alleged anti-competitive behaviour. And also, there will be a need to consider practical difficulties and how they can be managed in circumstances where there's absolutely going to be increased uncertainty.
Deba, that's absolutely right. And the scope for the two regimes to diverge after the transition period comes to an end is going to be subject to the outcome of negotiations between the UK and the rest of the EU on what the future trading arrangement should look like. But it's worth bearing in mind that we're starting, obviously, from a position where the two regimes are exactly the same. And so divergence is not going to happen overnight. And we would consider it relatively unlikely that there'll be significant diversion until at least the medium term, and there'd need to be a good reason for that. Having said that, there are a couple of proposals which are being, or consultations which are being taken forward in each place, and I think the CMA is thinking about revising its merger assessment guidelines, and the Commission has announced a planned revision of its market definition guidelines. So there are early sort of opportunities for the two authorities to take slightly different views, although, you know, whether that results in much in practice remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think as well, we'll probably come on to discuss later in this podcast. I think that's probably similar in the sphere of enforcement too. Possibilities for change in the medium term as different courts potentially take different views on the underlying law.
So, Alex, you mentioned the new merger guidelines that might be coming out of the CMA. So let's talk about what Brexit means for deals more generally. So what's going to change for companies in this next year while we're in the transition period? And then what happens at the end of 2020?
I think the first point is nothing is going to change immediately, and the transition period preserves the status quo for a while. But most fundamentally, as we get to the end of the transition period, the UK will, you know, at the end of that period, leave the one-stop shop for merger control, which has existed for the last 30 years in the EU. So as many people know, the EU merger regulation really assigns jurisdiction to review the biggest cross-border deals exclusively to the European Commission. That will end, and the CMA will have jurisdiction as well where its own regime is triggered. What's different then? Because I think it is fair to say that all large international deals at the moment have to file in lots of different regimes around the world. So in some senses, this is just one more. So why the fuss? And I think, look, to some extent, that's correct. But it's worth bearing in mind, however, that the CMA and the European Commission are both known as very experienced and thorough authorities. The CMA in particular, one of the world's most experienced and interventionist authorities, and is on record as believing that it has under-enforced against deals in the past. So I think that's what's coming to the largest deals which companies want to embark upon, not just a review by one senior European agency, but by two.
And it's probably worth saying there, both in the merger context and also I think in enforcement too, that the CMA is absolutely stepping up to the plate in terms of logistically getting ready for Brexit. So it's had a big jump in funding, around £30 million. It's hired around 300 new lawyers. And its annual report and plan is replete with statements of the CMA getting ready to take to the world stage.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot for companies to be perhaps even a bit nervous about when we get into 2021. But in the more immediate period during the transition in 2020, what do companies have to think about if they are looking at transactions over that period?
The withdrawal agreement prevents the CMA from investigating deals which have been notified to the European Commission by the end of the year. So what that means, notified, so as many people will have experienced, often you have a long period of pre-notification before you formally notify, but it's the notification date which is the key here, and that crystallizes jurisdiction. So if you've notified on or before the 31st of December 2020, you stay with the European Commission, unless the existing referral rules come into play after that date, and sometimes that happens, but that's obviously a minority of cases. So the transitional period crystallizes jurisdiction in that way. But, people who are familiar with merger control regimes in practice will understand that there's, as you get closer to those to that deadline, there are going to be a number of other dynamics in play. And so to start off with, there is this pre-notification period. How can merging parties be certain that the Commission will have accepted their filing as complete by the 31st of December? And actually, let's all remember that that's the 23rd of December in practice because the Commission shuts down for Christmas. Given the volume of evidence that's required on the largest deals and the amount of time, in some cases, pre-notification can stretch up to 6 months in some of the more difficult cases. When in practice will companies need to start pre-notification? Well, for the most complex deals, they need to start thinking about it now, but the process can last up to 6 months. And so by the time we get to the summer, you're really sort of on risk that in fact it might be a close run thing to get your deal actually on the clock. What in practice will merging parties need to do? I think they'll need to be, as you get closer to the end of the year, increasing levels of engagement with the CMA as well as a shadow authority, because I think if there is a likelihood or risk that in fact you will slip into the new year 2021, then it'll make sense to parallel track your pre-notification processes. We saw the CMA doing this last year when we were getting closer to a Brexit date with no deal, and they very much geared up to monitor and shadow cases which are going through the European Commission because they were expecting to have to take on board some of those. And I think we'll see the same sort of dynamic coming through at the end of the transition period as well.
What level of interaction were you seeing between the CMA and the Commission as we were approaching that cliff edge last year? And do you expect to see the same again now?
So the levels of interaction, I think, last time round were a little bit harder to pin down because I think everybody, the European Commission wasn't able to talk about a no-deal Brexit. The CMA was gearing up for that possibility. So there's a slightly different dynamic. This time round, everyone will be friends. We're talking about, a managed exit. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll certainly see the CMA engaging with the parties on cases which fall into this category. And I would expect there to be a much greater level of cooperation between the CMA and the Commission, given that it's an agreed sort of scenario now. I think perhaps the more interesting question will be, with those cases where it's getting close, will there be any scope for political pressure to be brought to bear, either on the Commission or the CMA, to try and accelerate or decelerate pre-notification so that a case with particular significance to the UK, for example, actually ends up being reviewed by the CMA rather than the Commission. Now, I'd fully expect the official line on that to be that the system will be operated in entirely the same way as it always has been. But I think what happens in practice, I think, will be interesting.
Absolutely.
Debra, do you see the same thing already on the investigation side? Or are there sort of shadow investigations already happening in the UK that we'll pick up?
No, frankly. And some of that's, I think, also just due to the very different cadence of investigations. In the enforcement regime as we currently have it, obviously, essentially, the most significant cases, because of the nature of the products and services in question, because of their cross-jurisdictional nature, do get sort of bumped up to the Commission. And then at that point, the CMA essentially has always traditionally bowed out, and it's been sort of hermetically sealed at that point. At the moment, and certainly the CMA just last week produced guidance stance on how it's approaching the withdrawal agreement and the transition period, has said as we get closer to the line on sort of 31 December 2020, there's a possibility of them engaging in cases which have a UK component, which are currently being looked at by the European Commission. And in that context, they may start having conversations with the European Commission. And certainly during the transition period, the CMA obviously remains part of the European Competition Network, and so we'll have a sort of a flow of information and a line into the Commission for cases it wants to discuss.
Alex, in the complex mergers that are likely to involve remedies, are there any tricky issues that are going to come up there during the transition, and how do parties then deal with that risk in the SPA?
Well, I think the principle in the withdrawal agreement is fairly simple. If you trigger EU jurisdiction by notifying before the end of 2020, then the European Commission maintains jurisdiction throughout that case, including requiring, accepting, and then monitoring remedies. In other words, that sort of that case will be preserved in its own microcosm of EU law applying to it, notwithstanding that perhaps most of the case review, or indeed the remedy discussions, have happened after the transition period has ended. However, the withdrawal agreement does provide for the possibility of the CMA taking over monitoring responsibilities for remedies that affect the UK, or certainly the UK aspect of those remedies. There would need to be further legislation in the UK to enable that, but that's certainly a possibility, and I can see the CMA being interested in doing that going forward for remedies which really bite to a significant extent on the UK territory.
So as we think about things like remedies, litigation risk, I think this brings a more fundamental question up, which is, if parties are looking at a deal in 2020, how do they deal with all of this in the SPA?
Again, some of this is simple, some of this is more complicated. I think in terms of providing for conditionality in your SPA, do you deal with the European Commission or the CMA or both? Well, you can draft that in. I think in much the same way that we've been drafting in multiple clearance requirements around the world for a long time. So I think it's easy enough to provide that, whichever authority has jurisdiction, a CPU relates to it. And I think that's probably the first point. There are some more material points, though. I think first and foremost, the disparity in timing between the two regimes, particularly when you get into remedies discussions, and perhaps we'll touch on that more later, but I think they don't, the timetables don't work together. And so when you're thinking about long stop dates in your agreement, how long you should assume between signing and closing, if you're going to be dealing with both the EU and the UK, and you may or may not have a case which is going to go into phase two, for example, the extended review phase, then that can have quite a material impact. And we'll need to think through those in advance and provide for them. I think perhaps another more interesting question is, in a world where you have both EU and UK review, at the moment at least, the UK regime is entirely a voluntary one. And so that gives rise to the possibility for sellers to require a buyer to take UK risk. Now, that may not be a big point in cases where you're facing similar issues in both in the EU review and the UK review, but where perhaps most of the difficulties in the UK, but you have to do an EU filing as well, you may find situations where actually it is for the first time now in a deal which in a large global transaction which would have previously needed to wait for EU clearance across the EU, including the UK, you'll now be faced with a situation where the sellers can insist that the buyer takes the risk on the UK element. That could be material where the UK element is going to be the most significant competitive issue. There's also debates that we have at the moment between buyers and sellers where the UK national regime is engaged will be played out across the largest deals around the world in due course. And I say while the UK regime remains entirely voluntary, because I think it's also worth bearing in mind that one of the proposals which the CMA is backing at the moment is a change in the UK system to make it at least partly mandatory, just to confuse things a little bit more. If that hybrid regime does come in, then we may find that this issue goes away in the sense that the largest deals are mandatory in the UK as well. But, there's some time to come, I think, before that actually gets implemented.
Alex, when we get into this world where you have parallel EU and UK filings, or the UK is another filing you need to manage, for companies that maybe have not had to go through the UK process at the moment, what should they know about it? What's different about a merger filing in the UK?
Sure. Well, let's start with the point I mentioned just a minute ago. There are different timetables. The UK merger control process is, I think, one of the longest by international standards. The phase one review is 40 working days, and there's also the need for significant pre-notification before we start the clock, as there is in Brussels. Compare that to 25 working days in Brussels. on a standard sort of phase one case. There are other differences. The phase two process is very different in the UK. It's a complete rehearing by an independent panel within the CMA. That has upsides and downsides, clearly. One of the downsides is sort of lack of access to decision makers in phase two, and it being a little bit sort of harder to sort of get sort of very clear sort of readouts of state of play during the course of the phase two process. The complete rehearing is also a benefit. So depending on your case and dynamic, there's swings and roundabouts there. As I mentioned, the UK regime is voluntary to a point at least. So that allows a seller to require the buyer to close their deal before receiving UK clearance. But any sort of regular customers of the UK regime will be very familiar with the far-reaching powers that the CMA has to freeze integration and to in some cases, to unwind integration. And obviously, by the time you get to phase two, there are several sort of prohibitions on actually closing or transferring assets at that stage. So it is an onerous regime, notwithstanding the fact that it's a voluntary one. And as I mentioned before, the CMA is a very interventionist regime and intends to become more so. And I think their attitude to document requests has become heavier over time. Their attitude to sort of oversights and breaches of in responses to those requests has become stricter. And we've seen a slew of fining decisions over the last year to 18 months, sort of demonstrating really that they're putting a bit of a marker down that they need to be taken seriously.
I think also, on that front, greater enforcement or the risk of enforcement does also open the door to the possibility of greater litigation. And certainly, you'd view the UK system as being more open to the possibility of more litigation than the EU system. And that's, in the UK, we have a specialist tribunal in the form of the Competition Appeal Tribunal that exercises a greater and stricter standard of review in effect over decisions of the CMA than the European courts do. The general court has traditionally in the EU operated a relatively hands-off standard of review. And that's sort of then borne out in cases that we've seen pre-exit, which demonstrate a willingness to take procedural and indeed potentially substantive points to the tribunal and actually get relatively quick relief. So the obvious example, which will be familiar to many, is the proposed Sainsbury's and Asda merger, where at the end of 2018, on a procedural point, admittedly, the parties went to the tribunal on, I think it was the 12th of December, and got a decision on that procedural point by the 18th of January. That's an unheard-of pace in contrast to the European regime, where the general court, even on a fast track and relatively contained matter, you'd be looking at getting a hearing in 8 months or so. So I think there's absolutely the possibility of greater litigation there. And what will that mean then, I think, in practice? Could the Competition Appeal Tribunal become a forum where deals could be stalled or even blocked? I can see a real risk of that as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. And two additional points to make, I think, on the CMA's sort of own peculiarities. I think, first of all, the UK sort of jurisdictional tests, one of them is based on turnover and is straightforward. The other one is based on share of supply. And what we've been seeing increasingly in recent years is the CMA taking a very expansive view on how to apply that jurisdictional test based on share of supply. It used to be the case that if you were confident that your target had no sales in the UK, you'd be relatively relaxed about it. I think that in particularly in certain sensitive industries like pharma and tech, that is increasingly less the case that you can do so. And the CMA is certainly looking at jurisdiction on a range of bases. So even targets which have no sales or minimal sales in the UK might find themselves nevertheless being found to qualify due to share supply being calculated on a different way. For example, based on number of employees, we've even seen the CMA thinking about patent registrations and other sort of much harder measures to self-assess.
And I think because of the speed with which the Competition Appeal Tribunal might be able to act, you may see parties thinking about whether on those sort of early jurisdictional decisions, whether it may still be worth it to try and challenge quickly, because that won't crater the overall deal timeline in a way that it would do at European level.
Right. And finally, coming back to remedies, and we've mentioned sort of remedies before, you know, the timelines between Brussels and London on remedies, when you offer them, when they get accepted, when you can actually negotiate them, they're very different. I won't go into the detail, but ultimately the timelines don't work together at the moment, and there will need to be some quite a lot of creative thinking on how to get those two to marry up when you have a remedies case both in the EU and the UK.
So, Alex, it sounds like a lot of this, you know, means a lot of process and procedural headaches for companies that have to deal with both processes. But are you seeing anything already that suggests that you may get to a different outcome at the end of the day in the UK and the EU?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, substantively, the fundamental question that the authorities are asking each other is the same. So I wouldn't expect there to be significant divergence on ultimate outcome. There are a few differences which you can think of, and in particular, I think the test applied at phase one, I think there is scope for the CMA to be more inclined to go to phase two than the European Commission, based on simply the way the law has been applied by the Competition Court, the Competition Appeal Tribunal in the UK. I think there is a lower threshold for references to phase two in the UK. But ultimately, the end result, I would not expect to be very different in many cases. I think there's certainly scope in the margin for there to be differences in appreciation of evidence, you know, on weight given to certain things, but I wouldn't expect that to be a really systemic difference. The CMA is focusing on specific issues now, data, and how that's used, so-called killer acquisitions. And as we mentioned earlier, the CMA will be updating its merger assessment guidelines to better reflect how digital markets function and recent sort of practice in that area. And that is an area very much where the CMA has been sort of at the forefront of enforcement in Europe. So whether all that amounts to a big difference with Europe, I'm not so sure it will, because ultimately the European Commission is also interested in killer acquisitions and data and the like. Perhaps another area of interest is the intervention rate. I think in the last year, the CMA referred to phase two approximately 20% of the deals it reviewed, and that's versus 2% of deals reviewed by the EU Commission. Now, that partly reflects the nature of the regime. Because it's voluntary, the CMA can target more problematic cases more so than, you know, the Commission has to take everything that gets notified to it. But it is probably worth noting that actually quite a number of the deals that did go to phase two in the UK were pretty small deals, at least as they affected the UK. The amount of turnover involved, certainly with the targets in question, in some cases were pretty small, notwithstanding the fact that the CMA does operate a sort of a de minimis mergers approach as well. They have nevertheless been willing to look at very small transactions.
Great. Well, Alex, it sounds like lots of issues to think about on the merger control side. But maybe let's shift over and think a bit about what's happening with antitrust investigation. So, Deba, if I have the misfortune to have a company that is Dawn rated by the EC next week, what do I need to be thinking about in terms of the potential for parallel investigations?
Sure. And that is an important and potentially complicated question. The legal position can be explained relatively straightforwardly, which is that unless the European Commission has formally initiated proceedings by the end of 2020, it will be open to the CMA to then open its own investigation from 1 January 2021. What does formally initiate proceedings mean? That means the Commission has issued a statement of objections or has progressed to the stage of commitments or settlement discussions formally. And that can happen, you know, in many cases, many months after a raid. So that creates a possibility that the Commission may start looking at something this year, but won't have proceeded to that relevant formal stage until after the end of the transition period, in which case absolutely the possibility for the CMA to initiate a parallel investigation does begin.
So for companies that are currently under investigation by the EC, and especially if those investigations are at a very early stage, what does that mean as a practical matter? Are we talking about parallel markers, or what do they need to do?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think in practical terms, it would be important to assess what stage of the investigation the Commission is really at and where it's likely to get by December. That is not necessarily straightforwardly ascertainable. European Commission investigations do not run to strict timelines in the same way that merger review processes do. And engagement with the case team on timing can be difficult. we should, I think companies will also need to then consider what is the likelihood of the CMA wanting to investigate the relevant business or area of business and conduct. That will be determined by UK nexus of conduct and also the CMA's current enforcement priorities, whether this is in a sector or a market the CMA is particularly interested in or fits with one of its enforcement priorities at present, for example, a big focus on consumer protection and protection of vulnerable consumers. It would be important to assess whether it's appropriate to lay down a protective marker with the CMA in those circumstances, because if the CMA is going to commence its own parallel investigation, it will determine its own sort of leniency queue by reference to applications that have been made to it, and you won't necessarily automatically get the benefit of any approach that's been made to the Commission.
Hmm. I'd certainly agree with that, actually, Deb. I think it's always been the case, hasn't it, that protective markers at member state level have been things we always have to think about. And I think even more so in the UK.
Exactly right. I mean, at an early stage of investigation, it's never necessarily clear whether the EU is going to take jurisdiction anyway, whether the market in question is genuinely pan-European, whether it fits the European Commission's view of its own jurisdiction. So we have always advised our clients where there's a potential risk to put down markers at national level. So in some respects, that doesn't mean there's a change of practice there, but it's absolutely something that we should be considering and taking into account because it's another sort of one-stop shop that will fall away.
Mm-hmm. And there are some slight differences which exist at the moment, which might be interesting going forward in the sense that, as we know, the European Commission has been sort of developing recently a sort of an informal system of granting leniency for, if you like, not the classic hardcore cartel, but the vertical sort of price fixing cases.
Yeah.
Whereas actually one distinction that's existed for a while is that the UK actually has formal immunity and leniency for those vertical cases.
Precisely. So absolutely. It's not only the mere fact of regulatory intervention, but it is also the possibility that other forms of immunity might be on the table in the UK that aren't necessarily available in the EU or in other EU member states.
So, Deba, what can we expect after the transition period generally?
The CMA's guidance has indicated that as it approaches the end of the transition period, in cases where it does or is contemplating exercising concurrent jurisdiction or its own jurisdiction, it may start approaching companies for information. Again, depending on the sector, depending on the CMA's enforcement priorities, we might see requests for information emerge towards the end of the year. The CMA have made clear that that doesn't mean it will necessarily enforce those cases, but companies can expect to see RFIs emerging from the CMA at the end of the year. Substantively, though, enforcement priorities may diverge in the medium term, given the CMA's focus on particular sectors, as Alex was saying, tech, pharma. Given its focus on protection of vulnerable consumers, we may see just a very different pattern of enforcement activity after the end of the transition period. As I was saying at the start, the CMA does have an ambition to become a leading global regulator, and certainly optically it will want to be seen to be at work and serving the public. And as I mentioned, it's matched words with deed in that regard, with a large budgetary increase and hiring close to 300 new lawyers.
Do you think in the more medium term, long term, that we might see some actual legislative and policy shifts in this area?
Well, certainly the CMA is calling for greater powers, and its chair has recently suggested it should revisit, for example, the question of the appropriate standard of review to enable it to enforce, in its view, more effectively. We're waiting to see whether the government will adopt some of these proposals as policy in a forthcoming green paper. But it is certainly clear that the CMA is increasingly focusing on consumer protection. And I think one of the developments that we can look forward to in the UK in the medium to long term is seeing how competition law and consumer protection are fused. As was mentioned in the merger context, there is a focus on digital as well. And in the UK, there's been a proposal to establish a digital markets unit to look at enforcement, both competition enforcement and other forms of enforcement, be that consumer protection, data privacy, etc. And the government, I think, will take that forward. I think there's a question as to whether that's going to sit within the CMA or be an independent freestanding unit.
So if I can ask you a little bit about follow-on damages claims, I mean, historically, the UK has been actually a quite attractive place to bring those claims. Now, is that going to continue after the transition period, or are we going to close up shop?
That's a good question. I think we'll still see the UK being a very vibrant market for damages litigation, both follow-on and otherwise. I mean, certainly there are questions that are still to be determined. The question of jurisdiction over EU-UK cross-border commercial disputes isn't resolved by the withdrawal agreement or the political declaration, may form part of the negotiations of, as we move towards a new free trade agreement. Now, clearly, after the end of the transitional period, EU decisions will no longer be binding for the purposes of follow-on damages litigation in the UK. But clearly, there are a number of cases that are already in progress based on decisions that have already been made, and that litigation will obviously continue. And also, any new decisions that are taken during the transitional period will still have binding effect for the purposes of follow-on damages litigation. I think more broadly, the perceived advantages of the UK system remain, be that a comprehensive disclosure regime, which is viewed of as being very attractive to claimants, access to litigation funding. The UK litigation funding market is buoyant and dynamic. The perception of the UK, rightly, as having a specialist expertise in relation to competition law matters, be that in the form of a specialist tribunal, but also specialist claimant firms who are based here in the, in London. I also think there are some models of litigation which are clearly very attractive for claimants in the UK, which are yet to take root elsewhere in Europe. And in particular, of course, I'm thinking here of class actions. The UK has had a limited opt-out class action regime for UK competition claims since 2015. And certainly we're seeing that being pursued vigorously by claimant firms at the moment, 12 or so cases already on the books, including the largest ever claim in UK commercial litigation history, the multi-billion pound MasterCard claim.
All right. Well, thank you, Alex, and thank you, Deborah, for taking the time to walk us through what we can expect in this brave new world.
Not at all. Thanks, Jen.
Thanks very much.
So for our listeners, if you missed our first podcast episode where we talked about the major global trends we expect to see in antitrust enforcement in 2020, you can find that on our website at freshfields.com. And thank you very much for taking the time to listen today, and we will see you with our next podcast with more essential antitrust.